Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. Just a reminder once more before we start, there is a list of characters on the information, just so you can keep up with all the names during the episode. Amid the scourge of the Black Death, nothing could interfere with the King's tournaments. In Canterbury in 1349, the usual crowds assembled. However, the ladies of the court had items to protect themselves from the virulence of the virus. Face masks. Emerging from the deeply turbulent, chaotic reign of his father, Edward combined the regal majesty of Henry III and the military prowess of Edward Longshanks in marshalling the cult of chivalry. It produced the most glorious age in English history. This is Edward III. Edward was born in 1312, the son of Edward II and Isabella of France. Little is known of Edward's upbringing, but when he became a teenager, he was suddenly thrust onto the scene. Due to the poor leadership of his father, the king, his mother, Isabella, had fled to France, found a lover in Roger Mortimer, and was now planning to invade England and oust the king, her husband. The young Prince Edward would be the pawn. Within 5 months of invasion, the king's forces were depleted. The majority of his allies had abandoned him, and the ones that remained were violently executed. When the king was forced into abdication, the prince replaced him. He was crowned King Edward III on the 1st of February 1327 at the tender age of 14. Edward would reign, but rule he would not. He was soon growing into a man. He had a classic Plantagenet presence, well built, long hair, and hot-blooded. He, however, had a kindly countenance, which would serve him well and set him apart from many of his ancestors. He married Philippa of Hainaut in January 1328. It would be a relatively happy marriage that produced a very large family, 8 sons and 5 daughters. Large families helped secure the future of a father's lineage. This story is particular proof. The Queen was a popular consort who exercised a steadying influence over Edward and deputised for him. But in the late 1320s, Edward had a huge obstacle to real power, his mother and her lover. Roger Mortimer was now the de facto ruler of England. He perverted the principles of that which they sought to protect. He was rapacious and villainous. Along with Isabella, they simply couldn't resist exploiting the system to enrich themselves. Mortimer was made Earl of March. Isabella owned more land than any magnate. The couple was supremely powerful, but perhaps wise to the fickle nature of rule, Mortimer was deeply paranoid. While he took centre stage, dressed as King Arthur, he ensured the true king was out of sight. He was rarely seen in public. It wasn't just this Edward Mortimer was concerned about. His father was locked away in Berkeley Castle, and numerous attempts had been made to rescue him. Mortimer acted. It is generally believed that he ordered the murder of the former king. When the old king's brother was accused of plotting his escape, Mortimer showed his wicked colours. He was to be put to death. But no one wanted to wield the sword. They had to find a convicted murderer and offer a pardon in order to secure an executioner. The execution of Thomas of Lancaster had been trumped. To order the killing of a son of Edward Longshanks was a new low in an already depraved, bloody culture. The young king's friend, William Montagu, persuaded him to act. Better to eat dog than be eaten by the dog. In October 1330, the court, including Mortimer, was at Nottingham Castle. Word spread of a potential coup. He interrogated the king's men, but soon let them go. He was right to be suspicious. After nightfall, they returned. They were let in a secret subterranean passage into the heart of a castle, where they met the teenage king. When they burst into the room, where the couple and their loyalists were at council, Mortimer rushed for his sword, but was restrained. Isabella stood, helpless and sobbing. The sheriffs of the land were swiftly informed that henceforth the king would govern his people according to right and reason. Mortimer, bound and gagged, was presented to Parliament. Perhaps the most damning list of charges in the history of English law was read to him. It included siphoning royal funds, waging war, usurping power, framing Edmund, and killing Edward II. On the 29th of November, 1330, he was hanged. Isabella would not share his fate. She would spend the next 27 years in luxury confinement, but her days in power were over. She had been replaced by her 18-year-old son, a young, ardent, and active king who sought to turn England into a powerful nation. The rule of perhaps the greatest Plantagenet king had begun. The failures of Edward II and foolishness of Roger Mortimer had given the formidable Robert the Bruce, King of Scots, his greatest achievement. The Treaty of Northampton in 1328 had granted Scotland its independence. Edward had reluctantly signed it. The Scots were now running amok on English territory. Now Edward was the real ruler. He sought to follow in his grandfather's footsteps and force Scottish submission to English primacy. In 1329, Robert Bruce died and was replaced by his 5-year-old son, David Bruce. Edward Balliol led a group called the Disinherited. They looked to seize the crown of Scotland from the infant. Edward was the son of King John Balliol, the man Edward Longshanks, Edward III's grandfather and former king, helped place on the Scottish throne in exchange for subjugation. Edward III looked to repeat the exchange with the new Balliol, Edward. Edward III tore up the Treaty of Northampton. York became England's capital for 4 years as the English force of oppression campaigned ruthlessly in Scotland. At the Battle of Duplin Moor, Edward Balliol was victorious and subsequently crowned King of Scotland. During round two, at the Battle of Halidon Hill in 1333, the Bruces were crushed once more by the English led by their king. According to an English chronicler, the Scots' armour was bathed in blood. On that day, the Scots had no more numerical superiority than 20 sheep have against 5 wolves. David Bruce went into exile. 8 years later, in 1341, he returned for one final showdown at Neville's Cross. It was another defeat against the superior English army. David Bruce was captured and thrown in the Tower of London. The king had safely installed his puppet. Edward III had already achieved more than his father had in his entire reign, but it would be against another neighbour where Edward would make his name, France. Edward inherited the increasing hostility with France from his father due to the disputed English rule of Gascony, France's support of Scotland, and England's support of the French enemy, the Flemish. In 1328, crisis hit France when the 400-year Capetian dynasty collapsed when Charles IV died without an heir. His cousin, Philip VI, became king. Under his mother and Mortimer, Edward could do nothing, but now he could. In 1337, Edward did something momentous. He declared himself the rightful king of France. Through his mother Isabella, the daughter of a former French king. Like Philip VI, Edward was also a cousin. Though through Salic law no female could inherit the throne, Edward certainly didn't agree with the original quarrel over a speck of France, Gascony. Edward was now claiming the entire kingdom with 4 times the population of England. He replaced the old royal arms of 150 years with one that included the ancient arms of the French crown and the fleur-de-lis. This was no gimmick or cheap political manoeuvre. He proclaimed that his subjects offer him, the King of France, due fidelity to secure peace, defence and protection. He swore to make war on Philip VI by word or deed, set his country ablaze, and await his arrival on the field of battle. Philip confiscated Gascony. By the summer of 1337, the Hundred Years' War had begun. Significant battle did not commence for 3 years. Edward struck when he hunted the gigantic French invasion fleet at Sluys in June 1340. He was begged not to go. Warned of the peril of sailing, Edward's 120 ships and 12,000 men faced a French force of 200 ships and 19,000 men. Edward shouted, "Those who fear, where there is nothing to fear, should stay at home." But the king was no folly visceral leader. With sun, wind, and tide behind him, he struck. The king's ship was at the very front of a spear-headed attack. He fought on, even when struck with an arrow through his thigh. Medieval sea battles consisted of ships crashing, men boarding, and engaging in hand-to-hand combat. The ships clashed. Though the French outnumbered the English, their whole force could not attack at once. Yet the English could. While the first line of French took the full force of the English navy, the second and third lines were helpless to aid them. The French were decimated. When the first line of French defence was broken, the second succumbed too. The third line fled. The French lost 17,000 men and 166 ships. The French chronicler Froissart quipped, "The sea was so filled with blood that the fish spoke French." They'd lost their invasion force, and England was spared. Now Edward could look to produce his own. The campaign on land in 1340, however, to coincide with Sluys, was less successful. It achieved little and was phenomenally expensive. The bill was at least £400,000, an obscene amount of money for the time. In a familiar story from past reigns, Parliament refused Edward money for war. The country was broke. Edward squeezed the country of its pennies and even had to pawn the crown jewels. But the story would not end here. Queen Philippa gave birth to a son in 1330, also called Edward. At 16 years old in 1346, he would accompany his father on a brand new campaign to claim France. He was no ordinary man. The son would become known as the Black Prince, named for the colour of his armour, or perhaps his heart. The early stages of the campaign lacked strategic purpose. As written by the king himself, "We held ever our road forward, our people burning and destroying, commonly to the breadth of 12 or 14 leagues of country." The landing in Normandy had been symbolic. The king even went to visit the tomb of William the Conqueror, yet they laid waste, leaving the peasants at the mercy of murderous brigands. It was the same land that King John had fled over 100 years before. The campaign was beginning to take shape as the king took Caen. The pillaging and raping continued as the English made swift progress. In Paris, the biggest city in Europe, panic set in. According to Jean de Valette, the burning of villages could be seen by anyone in Paris who could ascend a turret. Luckily for the Parisians, the French army met the English just outside the village of Crecy on the 26th of August, 1346. 35,000 Frenchmen met just 15,000 Englishmen in one of the most famous battles in history. 35,000 included 6,000 highly skilled Genoese hired crossbowmen. They would be met by a new, revolutionary, and devastating weapon, the longbow. It had been used tactically, for the first time, at Halidon Hill and Slough. Now, on the continent, it was about to become famous. The bow was 6 foot in length, made of yew, and fired ash arrows. The draw strength was 200 pounds, requiring hugely powerful men to operate. As the armies faced off, it began to rain. The longbows were loosed. They could penetrate armour from 200 feet, way out of a crossbow range. They could also be fired 5 times faster. The French were sitting ducks. Still, with great confidence in numbers, and bolstered by the sound of kettle drums, trumpets, and the thunderous screams of a gargantuan army, the French charged. They were met with a hail of arrows. 6 arrows from each bow per minute fell on them like snow. 15 times the cavalry and infantry charged, and only one reached the English. The field was writhing, screaming, chaos. The sound of cannon fire could be heard on the battlefield for the first time in Europe. It was wildly inaccurate, and was useful only in scaring horses. The French had no counterattack, and were defeated. It was a momentous victory for the English. The French lost tens of thousands of men, including 1,500 knights. The English lost just 80 men and 2 knights. For 1,000 years, the horsemen dominated the battlefield. It was said they could do more on the field in 1 hour than 20 could do on foot. No more. It was now the age of the longbow. When the last depleted cavalry charge reached the English, the 16-year-old Black Prince was in the thick of the action, being hammered by the angry French. When the king was asked whether his son should be relieved, he said no, let him earn his spurs. He did. Among the dead was a blind king of Bohemia, loyal to Philip. The Black Prince took the 3 ostrich feathers from the king's crest, and his motto, Ich dien, I serve, and adopted them as the Prince of Wales. It is still used by Prince Charles to this day. The campaign would not end at Crecy. Edward III marshalled a force of English and Flemish soldiers of up to 50,000, the largest such in the Hundred Years' War, and besieged Calais. Philip mustered a force half of its size, but turned back. After almost a year, and on the brink of starvation, Calais capitulated on the 3rd of August, 1347. It provided England with an important strategic enclave for the remainder of the Hundred Years' War, and beyond. The trials and logistics of war meant the English had to return home eventually. They returned as heroes. It had been an overwhelmingly successful campaign. it radically changed the image of the English from incompetent weaklings to formidable, astute warriors. So revered was Edward, he was offered the throne of the Holy Roman Empire. With a job still to do in France, he declined. So crucial was the longbow to English success, the king banned all sports other than archery in the realm on pain of death. He also wiped the debt of the craftsmen. On the 23rd of April 1348, on the feast of St. George, the king founded the Order of the Garter, a fellowship of his greatest leaders through an exclusive chivalric order. 26 members were knighted at St. George's Chapel. These men were now partners in war and peace, promoting honour in battle. The members were Edward's most loyal, powerful warriors, men he had known and gone to war alongside for 20 years, men who were loyal and driven, yet not personally ambitious. Edward's ruling policy of interdependence meant respect was mutual and advice duly shared. It included the 18-year-old Black Prince and his men, who would carry the torch for the next generation. A stone headquarters was also planned with an Arthurian round table, a physical centre for the cult of chivalry. Windsor Castle was also restored, in line with the majesty of kingship. A magnificent palace was constructed, befit with the first public clock. Huge amounts of spectacles showcased this new era. Regal feasts, romances, plays of dangerous liaisons captured the feeling of the new culture. Tournaments were like country clubs for knights. These social gatherings built camaraderie, vital for the battlefield, but also played a crucial role in building skills for warfare, in one-on-one combat, and also as part of a group in orchestrated mock battles. Edward had transformed a decrepit, bitter, divided nation of unruly, distrustful barons into a united force in a glorious era for England. But the mirth of the nation would be wiped, almost in an instant. In the summer of 1348, a new ruthless enemy hit the shores of Bristol. Within weeks, it had killed 40% of the city's population. It then engulfed the entire country, travelling at 3 miles a day. It was the Black Death, the plague. Henry Knighton, a chronicler, describes, "There was no memory of death so stern and cruel since the time of Vortigern, King of the Britons, in whose day the living did not suffice to bury the dead." It had spread across Europe without relent, and had reached Britain. It was transferred by fleas infecting rats. When the rat died, it would infect another. The population was ravaged. They developed egg-sized buboes filled with black pus, giving an unbearable odour from every crevice. By chroniclers, it was described as a pestilence of pure sin, a chastisement from heaven. It would kill a third of the population. But what was left, if you were a peasant, was a crop unspoilt, and labourers in high demand due to the death of so many. It meant wages rose. The royal house was at this point unaffected, and the king quickly prevented this rise with the Statute of Labourers, restricting wages to pre-Black Death levels. If any man takes more, he shall be committed to the nearest jail. This was not very effective. All it did was build resentment. From a position of power, the peasantry began to rumble. This rumble would continue to grow long after the reign of Edward. By the 1350s, Edward was eager to continue his campaign. For all the pomp of the late 40s, he had still to claim France. In 1350, news reached the king that a treacherous Italian mercenary was ready to betray the English at Calais. The king and his loyal men entered the castle unseen. As the traitor raised the flag, a signal was sent to the French to reclaim the city. When half had entered, the French were flummoxed to see the drawbridge was being lifted. The ones inside were trapped. With the scream of, "For Edward and St. George," they were ambushed. The king, as he usually did, was dressed as a knight in order to escape detection and giving him the ability to fight. The incursion was quelled. Calais would remain English for 200 years. England was still at the pinnacle of European chivalry, but with the majesty comes the need to prove oneself once more. Campaigns led by the Black Prince and the king's other son, John of Gaunt, in 1355, saw troops marauding across Brittany, Gascony, and Armagnac, burning and pillaging as they went. On the 19th of September 1356, the Black Prince led the English army as they faced off against the new French king, John II, at Poitiers. The young commander was in the absence of his esteemed father, but with a corps of the Order of the Garter, the prince would hope for the same result as Cressy. He didn't get it. It was even more momentous. Outnumbered 2-1, the French fell foul once more to the deadly longbow, wielded by the Welsh, Gascons, and English. It was the most crushing defeat of any Plantagenet over a French king. Thousands more French were killed and more captured. The most high-profile captive was the king himself, John II. All those knights were treated with chivalric deference. John even dined with the Black Prince after his defeat. He was sent to the Tower of London to sit alongside David Bruce, the defeated former King of Scots. After Poitiers, Paris was attacked, but the English had overreached. Nonetheless, by 1360, Edward was at the zenith of his power. He had two kings captive and controlled a quarter of France. He demanded an eye-watering £666,666 for the ransom of John. It made Richard the Lionheart's ransom look like pocket change. It would seem that Edward was in a position to demand everything, but as phenomenal as the victories were, France was vast and conquest was long and arduous. At the Treaty of Brittany, Edward relinquished his claim to the throne of France in exchange for the land he had conquered, a significant chunk of France, territory that wouldn't have entered the dreams of his father Edward II when he quarrelled over a homage for a Gascon speck. When John was ransomed and returned to France in December 1360, he found a country in wretched ruin. As Barbara Tuckman described, France was a land of well-conducted chivalry, where uncouth German nobles came to learn good manners and tastes of courts, where sovereigns came to the court to enjoy jousts, festivals, and amorous gallantries. Now the nation was broken. In a land perennially raided, raped, and pillaged by the English and foreign mercenaries, it was on the brink of utter anarchy. Chronicler Jean de Venette saw a lamentable spectacle of scattered, smoking ruins to which they had been reduced by devouring flames. Another chronicler, Jean Lebel, recorded the killing of a knight by peasants. The knight was then roasted on a spit and fed to his wife and children. Mercifully for the French, the tide was about to turn once more. The new king was Charles V, the fourth during Edward's reign, and by far the most shrewd, confident, and aggressive. He rejuvenated the beleaguered French army, and French spirit and national feeling grew. When he repudiated the treaties, Edward resumed the title of King of France. War would resume. But while Charles harboured grit and a thirst for vengeance, Edward displayed no such vigour. A return of the Black Death in 1361 had meant tragic consequences for his family. Two of his infant boys succumbed. His daughter, on her way to her wedding, also died of the Black Death. It was a disease that did not discriminate. In 1369, the Queen died. She had never recovered after falling off her horse. The King was hit again with sheer grief. On top of this, his own health was failing. This all meant that warfare was left in the hands of two of his sons, the Black Prince and John of Gaunt, who struggled to dampen the national fever of the French. A few feeble jaunts into battle in the 1370s were the last actions of the great king. Fresh tactics of defence meant the French repelled the longbow effectively, and the English began to lose. They lost their grip on their newly found territory. The Black Prince was left in charge of Aquitaine. The prince was a formidable warrior and military leader, but he was a poor statesman and diplomat. he failed to gain any allies and ruled with an iron fist. Where Edward sought advice, the prince ignored it. He treated the locals with disdain when he launched a campaign in Castile for personal gain and footed them with a huge bill. It meant that when the French army reached the towns of Aquitaine, the gates were left wide open. None of this prevented the prince from continuing to excel on the battlefield. At the Battle of Najara in 1367, he achieved yet more glory, but at a cost. He contracted dysentery, a violent disease that left him incapacitated for nearly a decade. When he returned to Aquitaine, the betrayal of his people unleashed murderous fury. He sacked the town of Limoges. No man, woman, or child was spared. It was burned to the ground, as the disgraceful, ailing prince literally barked out orders of murder and destruction while lying in a litter. This depraved act was his last on the continent, in what was a sad end to an accomplished career, as he relinquished control of Aquitaine to his father and returned to England a broken man in 1371. The king was in no position to take up the mantle. By the 1370s, he was deteriorating physically and mentally. He had sunk into dotage. In 1375, with rapid French success, he had little choice but to sign the Treaty of Bruges, which reversed almost all his gains, retaining just Calais and Gascony. After decades of baronial peace, they were once more discontent. When the queen died, Edward became heavily influenced by a young and fiercely ambitious mistress called Alice Perez. Now he was growing senile. This was becoming dangerous. She was claiming huge expenses from the treasury. At the same time, the king's son, John of Gaunt, was demanding more money for war. In the good parliament of 1376, the first ever elected speaker of an increasingly powerful House of Commons banished the mistress and Gaunt's pro-war associates. With the majority of the old order dead, and the king and the prince incapacitated, familiar baronial schisms widened. On the 8th of June 1376, the Black Prince died, at the age of 46. Inscribed on his tomb, "On earth I had great riches, land, houses, and great treasure. But now I am a poor captive, deep in the ground I lie. My great beauty is all gone. My flesh is wasted to the bone." A year later, on the 21st of June 1377, the king finally died, after numerous strokes at the age of 64. He was survived by only 4 of his 13 children. In one of the most lavish funerals in English history, all of London was draped in cloth, as a 3-day funeral procession marked a reign of half a century. He was buried at Westminster Abbey. The death of the Black Prince and the king left a difficult succession. The crown would fall to another child, the king's grandson, the prince's son, 10-year-old Richard of Bordeaux. In the words of Chronicle Bona, he was the flower of earthly warriors, under whom to fight was to rule, go forth was to prosper, to contend was to triumph. During the reign of Edward, there was a titanic shift in the fabric of England. The language was fast becoming English for all, as poets Chaucer and Gower led a new age of literature, and the House of Commons became a true force. The country enjoyed 50 years of domestic peace, while his neighbours faced belligerence. He was the first King of England to declare himself King of France, something all future kings would claim until Napoleon Bonaparte. The glorious era, the victories of Crecy, Poitiers, and Calais, were not solely the work of Edward, but of the patriotic, enthusiastic stalwarts at his side, in theatres of war and deeds of arms. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for Richard II. You can follow us on Twitter at Kings Queens Pod and on Facebook, the Kings and Queens Podcast. If you have a question, you can tweet or you can send an email to thekingsandqueenspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.